It's Thursday, December 14, 2017. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. We'll see how moral argument dies under social pressure, why a Down syndrome diagnosis reveals the sanctity of human life, not just genetics. We'll see a moral revolution lead to a new government in Palm Springs, California. We'll see an expanding set of letters for the sexual revolution and why religious activity is actually more revealing than religious identification. The issue of abortion re-enters our national conversation over and over again, at least weekly, almost daily, seemingly even hourly. And yet, how the issue re-enters the national conversation is itself important. Consider a recent report from National Public Radio. The headline of the report, Down Syndrome Families Divided Over Abortion Ban. Sarah McCammon reporting for NPR begins the story this way, quote, when a pregnant woman finds out she's likely to give birth to a baby with Down syndrome, she's often given the option to terminate the pregnancy. But families, she writes, affected by the genetic disorder, which causes developmental delays, are conflicted over whether such abortions should be legal, end quote. The background to this is the fact that Ohio is poised to become the latest state to outlaw abortion for the reason of a diagnosis of Down syndrome. But what makes this story so interesting in the lead is the fact that we are told that even families with children with Down syndrome are conflicted over whether or not the ban is morally right. Now, at this point, we simply have to make clear that about this, the Christian biblical worldview has no question. There is no conflict. Every single human life at every point of development, at every one of life stages, under every condition, including genetic conditions, is God's gift, and thus is to be recognized as being sacred, and thus is to be defended against all assaults. National Public Radio is one of the most careful media sources in the United States. It is often leaning to the left. At the same time, it holds itself to rather exacting professional standards. This reporter for NPR, like most, goes right to the heart of the question and seeks to find persons on both sides of the question. She goes first to a parent who indicated that when she had received this kind of prenatal diagnosis during her pregnancy with a boy named Oliver, now age 2, she said this, quote, when my provider called me and told me that the test came back positive for Down syndrome, I was definitely shocked. It was not what I was expecting at all. I grieved deeply. But she says that she never even considered terminating the pregnancy. In her words, quote, he's still a baby. He's still worthy of life just like everybody else. But in terms of the bill that would ban abortion for reason of Down syndrome, a bill that might reach the desk of Ohio's Governor John Kasich in a matter of days, this same mom said this, and I quote, I try not to bring this up, just because people are so passionate, and I value my friendships with people, end quote. The reporter then went to another mother, in this case, the mother of a 6-year-old girl with Down syndrome, and this mom said, I had seen people with Down syndrome before, and I knew they lived good lives. But she identifies as an abortion rights supporter, and she accuses pro-life forces within the state of Ohio of using Down syndrome in order to push an anti-abortion agenda. She said this, quote, Down syndrome is an easy face. Everybody knows somebody or has seen somebody or has a friend of a friend with Down syndrome. She said, so I really think Down syndrome is just kind of being the pawn to the bill, which is just restricting woman's choice, end quote. Now, that's stunning. Let's just wait for a moment and recognize that all this bill does is outlaw abortion when the abortion is undertaken for the singular reason of a diagnosis with Down syndrome. But now you have this pro-choice advocate, as she styles herself, who says that that's really just a ruse to restrict abortion. But what I found so absolutely incongruous was the fact that this same mom, who had clearly decided to give birth to her little girl, she said that she had seen people with Down syndrome before. And to use her own words, she said, and I knew they lived good lives, end quote. But on the other hand, she accuses those behind this bill of simply using Down syndrome as a ruse. And in the most amazing language, she says again that Down syndrome is, in her words, an easy face. Why? Because, again, to use her words, everybody knows somebody or has seen somebody or has a friend of a friend with Down syndrome. That's an absolutely stunning statement. Here you have a basic admission, an admission, by the way, that we should see as sustained by at least a vestigial power of the Christian worldview that says when you see a child with Down syndrome, you immediately understand that child deserves to live. But even as she decided to give birth to her child, she argues that it would be wrong to make that decision for all children with Down syndrome. But before we go too far with this, we just need to recognize this is the logic of abortion. It can't be disguised in any other way. Because when we're talking about abortion, remember that the abortion rights movement in this country argues not only for the right to abort babies that are diagnosed with Down syndrome, but any baby under any circumstance. But the logic of the abortion rights movement also comes through in a statement made by Catherine Romanos. She's identified as a family practice physician in Columbus who also performs abortion. She's against the bill. She said, quote, "They need information," speaking of women who are expecting children, receiving this kind of diagnosis. "They need information. They need their options." And then listen to this. She said, quote, "And then they need their healthcare professionals to be able to support any decision that they make," end quote. But recognize, we're not just talking here about a decision about some kind of elective surgery. We're not talking about a decision between medications. We're talking about a decision that will terminate an unborn human life. But before we leave that first mom, we simply have to recognize there is something very significant about the fact that even though she believes that every single child, including a child with Down syndrome, deserves to live, she goes on to say she doesn't talk about the proposed legislative ban because she values her relationship with people. That tells us something of how moral arguments simply disappear in a society under social pressure. That social pressure is undeniable and it is powerful, and there it is in full evidence. In the words of a mom who says, "I believe that every single child with Down syndrome deserves to be born, but I'm not going to make that argument in a political context when it might actually become a matter of law because it just upsets too many people." I do appreciate National Public Radio running this story, and I appreciate the way they ran the story. I think it is a big story, a bigger story, I think, than National Public Radio understands. Next, just a few days ago, another item that should have our attention. This one, a column in the New York Times by Frank Bruni. He's openly gay, very much an advocate for LGBT rights, but he writes about an interesting development in the city of Palm Springs, California. The headline of the article, "It's a gay, gay, gay government." What's he writing about? He's writing about the fact that the entire current city government of the city of Palm Springs, California is gay in one way or another. Bruni asked the question, what does it mean that for the first time in this storied city's history, and it seems the first time in the history of any city with the national profile of Palm Springs, not a single elected official at its helm identifies as straight? He asks, is this a revolution or a wrinkle, a triumph of diversity or something slightly different? He says that's exactly what the council members themselves are trying to figure out. Well, suffice it to say that by the time you summarize the article, the elected officials in city government in Palm Springs, California, are either identified as gay or lesbian or as transgender or as bisexual. As a matter of fact, the only interesting controversy, as it turns out, in the last election was over whether or not the woman identified as bisexual but married to a man is actually just trying to use a bisexual identity in order to get elected in the city of Palm Springs. Evidently, the voters decided that she was at least bisexual enough to be supported in terms of this all-gay government. Frank Bruni is clearly celebrating this, but again, he's asking the question, what does it mean? He helpfully articulates the historical context when he references the election and then says that it, quote, underscored the extraordinary journey of this city and this country over the past three decades. It was here, he says, in 1987 that Liberace, a longtime resident, died of complications related to AIDS after years of refusing to acknowledge his homosexuality and laying the blame for a sudden significant weight loss on a watermelon diet gone wrong. While his secrecy, says Bruni, had much to do with his own peculiarities, it also had much to do with America back then. We wore thick blinders. We made cruel judgments, end quote. Now, the important thing to recognize here is that we are talking about a total transformation in the moral landscape. We talk about it. Frank Bruni talks about it. Both of us recognize the same basic time span, the last 30 years. City officials estimated that between 20 to 40% of the residents of Palm Springs identify as either gay or lesbian. It's not only the elected officials who are gay. The city manager is gay. The assistant city manager is gay. The newly hired clerk of the city is gay. Speaking of this entire inversion of values and making direct reference to the bisexual woman who was elected after being challenged as not being gay enough, one of the political figures there in Palm Springs talked about calling the woman to test whether she was gay enough. The figure called the woman and said, quote, "Christy, I'm making the weirdest call I've ever made in my entire life. You're being accused of being fake gay, fake bi. This is a whole new world for me," said the official. "This is a parallel universe." The officials, pictured in the print edition of the New York Times with the article, are clearly reveling in this development in Palm Springs, but they're also struck at a bit of wonder of what it means. We are talking about one city, one very celebrity-rich, one very unusual city in terms of the total landscape of the United States, but we're also talking about what can't be denied as a major and significant development. And we're also talking about a situation that does make very clear that vast moral revolution that's taken place in this country over the course of the last 30 years. But going back to the development, Bruni writes that as he listened to the officials there in Palm Springs, quote, "I realize that what they want to be is the post-gay government, in which LGBT people are prominent not because they mirror their constituents, which definitely matters, but because they have valuable skills," end quote. He goes on to quote one of the city council members who said, "What if indeed we were able to solve the national problem of homelessness? It then wouldn't be just a gay achievement. It would be because of our ideas." But here's the problem with that entire theory. The only reason we're talking about this is because Frank Bruni, one of the most influential columnists of the New York Times, ran an article with the headline, "It's a Gay, Gay, Gay Government," and details just how gay this government is. It's a little outlandish to come to the end of the article, because otherwise there wouldn't be an article about the city government of Palm Springs, California, in the New York City newspaper. But it's a little outlandish to come to the end of an article, which is, after all, published in the New York Times, which otherwise wouldn't have any real interest in the city government in Palm Springs, California. It's a little outlandish to come to the end of the article and say, yes, it's true. The headline was, "It's a gay, gay, gay government." And yes, the details demonstrate just how gay it is. But the big story here isn't about being gay. But of course it is. That's why there is a story. That's why there is that headline. It can almost send your head spinning when you are told in one direction, this is all about being gay. And then in another direction, this really shouldn't be about being gay at all. But next along the same lines, I simply have to go across our northern border to Canada, where a Canadian teachers group at a conference, a teachers group, by the way, directed at elementary school teachers in Ontario, actually indicated just how expansive the new vocabulary, or for that matter, just the new initials are going to have to be in terms of acronyms for the moral revolution. This teachers group, known as the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, posted the news about inclusiveness training at one of their meetings, and at the very top of it were the new, at least at this point, expansive letters of our moral revolution. Not just LGBT or LGBTQ, but now listen carefully and don't miss anything. LGGBDTTTIQUAAPP. Just in case you dropped a letter, I'll give it to you again. LGGBDTTTIQUAAPP. Now, some in the media tried to come behind this and say it was really satire. It was really a joke. Except when you look below the surface, it certainly wasn't. It was absolutely real. And furthermore, every one of those letters in terms of that long designation was identified. It's not just LGGBDTTTIQQAAPP. It is lesbian, gay, genderqueer, bisexual, demisexual, transgender, transsexual, two-spirit, intersex, queer, questioning, asexual, allies, pansexual, and polyamorous. And no, I'm not going to do that again. It might be necessary for some even to find out what some of those words mean. I'm not going to define them all either. Let's just say every single one of them has a place in the contemporary language and argument of the moral revolutionaries. One of the other claims made, by the way, in the posting is that as much as half of the public, quote, secretly identifies as LGBT to some extent, end quote. That's nonsense, of course, but it's the kind of nonsense that goes by many names and is increasingly familiar to us all. A nonsense that we can summarize simply by saying LGBTQIAPP, period. Finally, an important report appeared in Christianity Today in recent days. It's by Brad Wilcox, a professor at the University of Virginia. He's also the co-author of a recent book entitled Soulmates, Religion, Sex, Love, and Marriage Among African Americans and Latinos, that was co-written with sociologist Nicholas Wolfinger. He raises the question, are Christian men more abusive? He then writes, as a sociologist who studies family and marriage trends, I predict that in the coming years we'll see a growing wave of mainstream media and academic stories contending that religion, especially evangelical Christianity, hurts women, children, and families. He says, these stories will be framed around one key question. Is faith a force for ill in family life, from marriage in general to domestic violence in particular? Clearly, that's a very important question, but what Professor Wilcox helpfully points out in this article is that answering the question has everything to do with, once again, how you identify evangelicals. But from a theological and worldview perspective, he points to an even deeper insight. The insight comes down to this. Everything actually comes down to whether or not those men identified as evangelical are actually evangelicals who attend church. Professor Wilcox then writes about a previous book and previous research, and he writes that women, quote, married to church-going evangelical men, compared to women married to men in other major religious traditions, or women married to unaffiliated men, report the highest levels of happiness. He goes on to say their self-reports are based on two markers, love and affection you get from your spouse and the understanding you receive from your spouse. He says the same demographic of women also report the highest levels of quality couple time. But in this new book that he has co-authored with Professor Wolfinger, he says they have found similar findings. And then he makes these very important statements, and I quote, men and women who attend church together are almost 10 percentage points more likely to report that they are happy or very happy in their relationships compared to their peers who attend separately or simply don't attend religious services at all. On average, then, he says, evangelicals, as well as other religious believers in the United States, who attend church regularly enjoy higher quality marriages compared to their less religious or their secular peers. Later in the article, he says that church-going evangelical Protestant husbands were the least likely to be engaged in abusive behavior. There is clearly a problem in terms of abusive behavior inside marriage and between men and women, and not only that, between men and children. And in this article, Brad Wilcox says that that population can be increasingly identified as being nominal in terms of their religious affiliation, even when that religious affiliation is evangelical. That's a crucial distinction to which we have pointed over and over again, sometimes in the context of political controversy. When people are identified as evangelicals, as men or as women, or men and women together, oftentimes, they are simply identified because there is no other category the media has at hand. But it shouldn't come as a surprise to biblical Christians that the crucial dividing line comes not in the label attached to an individual, but when the question is actually asked, do you attend church? And once that question is asked, it turns out that church-going Protestant husbands are at the very bottom of the scale in terms of the threat of abuse of either women or children. There are so many things in this research and in this article to gain our attention and our thinking, but it's especially important to understand that crucial issue of church going. That shouldn't come as a surprise to Christians. But furthermore, it also reminds us that religious affiliation and identification simply do not tell us enough. They don't tell us enough about politics. They don't tell us enough about the current cultural context. They don't tell us enough about marriage and behavior in marriage. That means we have to look and we have to force others to look well below the superficial issue of identification and ask the question of activity. In other words, the question of faithfulness. That turns out to be a very different question that leads to a very different answer. A very important difference that shouldn't surprise any of us. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. Have you considered the importance of a college education that is grounded in the Christian worldview? It's something very important to us here at Boyce College, the college at Southern Seminary. I want to invite you to consider Boyce College this spring. We're proud to offer courses taught by some of the brightest scholars in Christian higher education today. If you apply this month, we're going to waive your $40 application fee. Just use the code word CHRISTMAS. To get started, just go to www.boycecollege.com/apply. That's BOYCE college.com/apply and use the code CHRISTMAS. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.